Chapter 19. Following President John F. Kennedy's death, much confusion reigned in Dallas. One result of great consequence was that the autopsy on his body was not performed in Dallas, but in Washington, D.C. The notion that the shots killing the president came from the Texas School Book Depository building, and only from there, based initially on only one source, a Dallas Times Herald photographer who told his account to a Washington Post reporter, is alarming for sure, since it obviously added to the Oswald alone theory being perpetuated after he was arrested. That theory has proven unworthy through the years, as pointed out in this author's multiple books and many others. This said, one may examine the autopsy in detail and decide whether the results are valid. There has been debate even to the point that JFK wasn't killed, that the autopsy was performed on another body, and so forth. Even delving into this viewpoint and many others about the autopsy triggers the proverbial can of worms, raising more issues than is possible for this book to cover. Of great importance, however, are the investigations that took place after the president died. By Executive Order No. 11130, signed by President Lyndon B. Johnson on November 29, 1963, the infamous Warren Commission was organized to investigate the assassination on November 22, 1963, of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, the 35th President of the United States. The commission was directed to evaluate all of the facts and circumstances surrounding the assassination and the subsequent killing of the alleged assassin and to report its findings and conclusions to the president. Commission members included United States Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren, Republican Congressman and future President Gerald R. Ford of Michigan, and former CIA Director Alan W. Dulles. The work of federal agencies bolstered their efforts, including the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Secret Service, with the former conducting, according to the report, more than 25,000 interviews and re-interviews of persons having information of possible relevance to the investigation. According to the final report presented on September 24, 1964, 6 months after completion of the Jack Ruby trial, the commission received the testimony of 552 witnesses, including 94 appearing before them, 395 questioned by commission staff, 61 supplying sworn affidavits, and 2 providing statements. Summing up their duties, the commission reported that it has functioned neither as a court presiding over an adversary proceeding nor as a prosecutor determined to prove a case, but as a fact-finding agency committed to the ascertainment of the truth. The Warren Commission's final report, 888 pages in length, concluded with this notorious statement under subsection 9. The commission has found no evidence that either Lee Harvey Oswald or Jack Ruby was part of any conspiracy, domestic or foreign, to assassinate President Kennedy. Summarizing the findings, the commission reported, among other matters, that there was 1. No evidence that anyone assisted Oswald in planning or carrying out the assassination. 2. No evidence that Oswald was involved with any person or group in a conspiracy to assassinate the president. 3. No evidence to show that Oswald was employed, persuaded, or encouraged by any foreign government to assassinate President Kennedy. 4. No evidence to support the speculation that Oswald was an agent, employee, or informant of the FBI, the CIA, or any governmental agency. 5. No direct relationship between Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby, and 6. No evidence that Jack Ruby acted with any other person in the killing of Lee Harvey Oswald. Based on these findings, the commission, under subsection 11, wrote that, on the basis of the evidence before the commission, it concludes that Oswald acted alone. Exposure of more information about Ruby and his trial in the mid to late 1960s caught the attention of several scholars interested in refocusing on the JFK and Oswald assassinations. But the true impetus for revisiting the Dallas tragedies occurred when questions regarding the thoroughness of the Warren Commission's investigation continued to surface. Doubting Thomas types were thus very pleased when the House Select Committee on Assassinations, HSCA, was convened in 1976, with its comprehensive report issued 3 years later. For months, it labored through secret sessions inspecting evidence and listening to witness after witness describe every nuance of the JFK and Oswald killings. The result of the Select Committee probe was an unanticipated bombshell. Members determined that there was a conspiracy to assassinate JFK. Some specifics were left to the imagination of the public, but there was little doubt that lone assassination theories regarding the killing had been debunked. Among the conclusions reached were the belief that a high probability exists that at least two gunmen fired a total of 3 shots at the president, with the second and third striking him and the third being fatal. The committee further believed that President Kennedy was probably assassinated as a result of a conspiracy, but it was unable to identify the other gunmen or the extent of the conspiracy. It discounted involvement in the conspiracy by the Soviet government, the Cuban government, anti-Castro groups, and the Secret Service, FBI, and CIA. The HSCA report also concluded that the National Syndicate of Organized Crime, as a group, was not involved in the assassination of President Kennedy, but that available evidence does not preclude the possibility that individual members may have been involved. While condemning the protection afforded President Kennedy by government agencies, including the Secret Service, the report also suggested that the investigation into the possibility of conspiracy was inadequate. Important to assessing the historical events in Dallas was the fact that the Select Committee raised new questions concerning Jack Ruby. Deciding there was much more complexity to the man probed by the Warren Commission, the congressmen investigated him thoroughly. A foreword to Volume 9 of the Select Committee report read, "Early in its investigation, as soon as it was realized that a plot of elements of organized crime in the United States to assassinate President John F. Kennedy warranted serious consideration, the committee decided to assemble the most reliable information available on the subject. The focus was to be primarily on the history of organized crime, the impact of the Kennedy administration's campaign against it, possible links of Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby with underworld figures, and the development of new evidence or leads." A few lines later, the report added, "A major reason for suspecting conspiracy was Oswald's murder by Jack Ruby." The Select Committee's portrayal of organized crime in America was chilling. Detailing the presence of gangsters in the United States since the late 19th century, the report stated, "While these groups have been called by various names, the Black Hand, the Mafia, the Organization, the Mob, organized crime, collectively, they are now most properly called La Cosa Nostra." By 1960, the report said, organized crime was flourishing. Senator John F. Kennedy and his brother Robert attempted to combat its influence. Allegations were made that they did so, the report concluded, to get even for mobsters having impinged on the success of their father, Joseph Kennedy. Much of his fortune, the report stated, stemmed from bootlegging, but mob boss Frank Costello's operation cut into Joe Kennedy's share of the profits. Now it was payback time, the report concluded, time for the Kennedy brothers to attack organized crime with a vengeance. To do so, the report noted that when RFK became Attorney General, as a first step, he dramatically expanded the number of attorneys in the organized crime and racketeering section of the Justice Department. He also, the report stated, put together a list of 40 organized crime figures who were targeted for investigation. On that list were Tampa-based Don Santo Trafficante and New Orleans Don Carlos Marcello. Regarding the latter, the report included an alarming account. Marcello was quoted, regarding his potential participation in JFK's death, as telling an informant, "The president was the dog. The Attorney General Kennedy was its tail. If you cut off the tail, the dog will keep biting. But if you chop off the head, the dog will die, tail and all." In other words, Marcello decided to strip RFK of any power by killing his brother. The HSCA report wasn't aimed at the CIA, but severely criticized the Justice Department, at the time headed by Robert Kennedy, for having largely abdicated what should have been important responsibilities in the continuing investigation. It then added, "Officials at Justice did not exercise any significant role in shaping, monitoring, or evaluating the FBI's investigation, despite the Bureau's organization status with the department." Continuing the criticism, the report also said that there was little indication Justice Department officials moved to mount a sophisticated criminal investigation of the assassination, including its conspiracy implications. It added that the department failed to use its power and capabilities of a federal grand jury and the granting of immunity. Most importantly, the committee decided FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover was wrong when he proclaimed that federal jurisdiction did not exist over the assassination because there was no evidence of a conspiracy in 1963, thus prohibiting the convening of a grand jury. To the contrary, the report stated that evidence did exist regarding a conspiracy and that a grand jury should have been convened. In addition, the report blasted Robert Kennedy's mental state in that it significantly affected the government's handling of the investigation. It also chastised him for failure to advance a strong position with Hoover on the course of the investigation. The HSCA conclusions reached in the late 1970s, on many levels, appear to mirror what would have been reported if Kilgallen had lived and published her account of the evidence she had gathered during her 18-month investigation into the assassinations. This, in turn, would have triggered the call for convening of a grand jury, one possessing evidence-gathering tools as a grand jury and grants of immunity, as noted by the committee. Amazingly enough, there appears to be little focus by the committee on the discrepancies Kilgallen knew existed between what the Warren Commission report investigated and then reported and the testimony she had listened to at Jack Ruby's trial. An examination of the 686-page HSCA report provides no indication that the committee ever read the trial transcripts. Such failure raises the concern that the HSCA investigation, while more thorough and impartial than the woeful Warren Commission, still lacked adequate focus and therefore remained similarly ineffective in resolving doubts about the assassination of JFK among the people of the United States and the world. Regardless, connecting the Marcello New Orleans empire to Dallas underlings is essential to connecting him to JFK's assassination. Without that link, a giant hole remains in proving that Marcello orchestrated the president's death. Certainly, the Mafia Don could have masterminded it without that connection, but to position the pieces to eliminate the president, he needed these underlings to set the scheme in motion. Those underlings then set up the trap for JFK with operatives, not just one, deployed in key spots where shots could be fired at JFK as the motorcade moved through Dealey Plaza. Several locations of preference existed: the grassy knoll, the book depository building, and the overpass area, with the latter the one Kilgallen had exposed as the location where DPD Police Chief Jesse Curry first sent officers after the shots were fired. Actually, regarding the Marcello-Dallas mob connection, a clue Kilgallen may have discovered came just after Jack Ruby was arrested, when the very first person to visit him was Dallas underworld figure Joe Campisi. He was a cohort of another Joe, Joe Civello, whom the U.S. Senate Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations had pegged in its report, filed July 30, 1964, as controlling all rackets in Dallas and the vicinity. Also, Kilgallen may have been aware that the contents of Ruby's car after he shot Oswald included, as noted, newspaper clippings detailing mob turncoat Joseph Valachi's appearance before a congressional committee. Why, she would have wondered, did Ruby have interest in Valachi if not for Ruby's connections to the underworld? In one of the very few books about the assassination not subject to complete ridicule, The Plot to Kill the President, 1981, written by former HSCA counsel G. Robert Blakey and Richard Billings, the authors, even though they somehow ignored Kilgallen's research, alleged strong ties by Ruby to the underworld. These included Campisi and Civello, the mafia family chieftain in Dallas. Both were linked to Carlos Marcello, whom author John H. Davis discussed in Mafia Kingfish. He disclosed that Campisi was fast friends with Marcello to the extent of sending Marcello 260 pounds of Italian sausage every Christmas made special with walnuts and celery. The association and the gift of sausage, Davis reported, were confirmed by Campisi when he testified before the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Regarding Civello, the same committee reported, "We established associations between Jack Ruby and several individuals affiliated with the underworld activities of Carlos Marcello. Ruby was a personal acquaintance of Joseph Civello, the Marcello associate who allegedly headed organized crime activities in Dallas." Bolstering these accounts were disclosures this author discovered in November 2019 by David Campisi, the grandson of Joe and owner of Campisi's restaurants in Dallas. A Dallas Morning News article with the headline, "Feds Investigate Owner of Campisi's as Large Bookmaker," includes allegations of David's ties to internet bookmaking websites in Costa Rica. While no charges had been filed at the time, the article referenced a 1999 Associated Press article that included the statement, "Gangsters used to hang out at the restaurant, and the family acknowledged that Joe Campisi was a golfing and racetrack buddy of New Orleans mafia boss Carlos Marcello." David Campisi was quoted as saying about his grandfather, "They were friends. Joe just knew everybody." Campisi's website provides the following information. The mysterious history of the Campisi family in America begins back in 1904, when my great-grandparents, Carlo Papa and Antonia Campisi, immigrated from Sicily to New Orleans. In 1946, with the end of World War II, Papa purchased a bar with a small kitchen in the back at the corner of Knox and McKinney called The Idle Hour. We moved to our Mockingbird Lane location in 1950 to take over the previous Egyptian Lounge. My grandfather, Joe, who raised me as his son, taught me a lesson in business. He said, "Baby, Campisi's was built on handshakes and hellos, and that's what we're still doing today." Jack Ruby, a friend to the Campisi family and regular at the restaurant, ate dinner at the Egyptian on the night of November 21st. He was a man known for his alleged involvement in the illegal underground activity of Dallas. The next day, November 22nd, as the presidential motorcade drove through Dealey Plaza in open-air limousines, President Kennedy was assassinated, shocking Dallas and the entire nation. Just 2 days later, as the Dallas police were escorting Lee Harvey Oswald from the police basement to an armored car to take him to a nearby county jail, Jack Ruby jumped from a crowd of reporters and fired a single round from a .38 revolver into Oswald's stomach, ultimately ending his life. Jack Ruby requested specifically that the Campisis come visit him in jail. On November 30, 1963, Joe Campisi and his wife visited with Jack Ruby for 10 minutes. Jack Ruby confirmed his having dined at the Egyptian restaurant as described by Campisi. In his accounts before the Warren Commission, specifically in answer to a question asked of him by Chief Justice Warren, Ruby was emphatic with his answer. He replied, "All right, Thursday night I was having dinner at the Egyptian restaurant on Mockingbird Lane." In 1978, the House Select Committee on Assassinations interviewed Joe Campisi regarding his association with Jack Ruby. Apparently, Campisi gave conflicting accounts regarding the relationship, but in the November 25th interview, he said he had known Ruby since about 1958, when Ruby moved to Dallas from Chicago and had attended a number of sporting events with him. While Kilgallen was pursuing the truth in Dallas, Nancy Regano, wife of Frank Regano, attorney for Carlos Marcello, Santo Trafficante, and James Hoffa, told this author she had watched Frank and Trafficante laugh, joke, and raise glasses of champagne high in the air. Each was toasting JFK's assassination at the International Inn, a five-star hotel in Tampa, Florida. Kilgallen's suspicions that Marcello was involved in the JFK assassination are bolstered by a statement made by Trafficante to Regano after the lawyer asked Trafficante about Melvin Billy's involvement in the JFK assassination. Trafficante replied, "Whatever you do, don't ask Billy about the assassination. It's none of your business," an indication that Billy was involved. Lightning struck when Kilgallen was able to print a series of articles of enormous historical importance, which proved to be the most unparalleled exclusive in her illustrious journalistic career. These articles exposed the Jack Ruby testimony at the Warren Commission before its official release date. The Kilgallen exclusive, one of hundreds she secured during her career, prompted fellow reporter Marianne Means from the Hearst Headline Services in Washington, D.C. to write, "Dear Dorothy, it is not my custom to write praise of other Hearst writers, no matter how good they may be, and as you are, but I must really compliment you on the Warren Commission scoop. You have literally gotten this town in a tizzy, everybody turning to it secondhand for themselves. Congratulations, a very good job. Yours, Marianne Means." Speculation surrounding the mystery as to exactly how this happened has always been of interest, but documents secured by this author through the National Archives provide concrete proof regarding how Kilgallen accomplished this amazing achievement. This proof is included in a letter/memo from J. Edgar Hoover to J. Lee Rankin, General Counsel to the Warren Commission, regarding how Kilgallen received the transcript of Ruby's secret testimony. Above his familiar signature, Hoover acknowledged that Rankin had requested an investigation as to how Kilgallen came into possession of the transcript of Ruby's testimony. The memo then states that accompanying pages set forth the results of interviews with Joseph Kingsbury Smith, publisher of the New York Journal American, and Dorothy Kilgallen on August 21, 1964. Which FBI agent wrote the account remains unclear, but of interest is Kingsbury Smith telling the interviewer that the publisher asked Kilgallen to identify the source who furnished her the transcript. The response was that she refused to reveal her source, but did indicate to him, the publisher, that the source was someone inside the commission who was a friend of hers of long standing. Further, Kilgallen told Kingsbury Smith that she would stake her reputation on the fact the transcript of Ruby's interview definitely was not stolen, not bought, and nothing illegal was done in obtaining it, that she would give her word of honor on this point. Concerning the transcript's publication, the publisher said he consulted with his attorneys and decided printing the transcript did not violate the law, and that it could be regarded as a journalistic matter. The next two pages of the memo chronicled an interview by the agent or agents on August 21, 1964, at Kilgallen's townhouse at 45 East 68th Street, New York, New York. Whoever wrote the memo recalled that Kilgallen refused to reveal the source, but acknowledged that it was a responsible person who had a legal right to the transcript. She told the agent, that she was the only person who knew the identity of the source, and that she would die rather than reveal his identity. This was based, Kilgallen asserted, on the right of a newspaper reporter to protect his sources of information. Asked if the source was a member of the President's Commission itself, or a staff member, or employee, or someone not on the commission, such as Ruby's defense counsel, Kilgallen refused to answer. Kilgallen also would not divulge the date she received the Ruby transcript or identify the city in which she obtained it. Kilgallen, the memo stated, admitted to the agents that the source was a man, not a woman, a friend of hers of long standing, and the source gave her the transcript as a friendly gesture. According to the document, Kilgallen would swear that the transcript was not stolen and nothing illegal was done in obtaining it. She stated that she did not pay money for the transcript and did not give or promise her source anything else of value in exchange for the transcript. The agent said Kilgallen refused to say if the source first approached her about the transcript. She told him the source had given her a typed transcript that she kept for several days and had copies made, including photostats, early projection photocopier, before giving the transcript back to her source. The agent, or likely agents, interrogating Kilgallen reported that she said the transcript was numbered from page 1 to page 103. She said one page was missing and believed it to be page 59. Page 103, Kilgallen stated, included a notarized statement from the stenographer who was present during Ruby's interview. Of special importance is the final paragraph of the memo, which read, "Miss Kilgallen volunteered to go to Washington, D.C. to testify on this matter before the President's Commission. She emphasized, however, that she also will refuse to identify her source to the Commission or anyone else. She stated that regardless of the consequences, she will never identify the source to anyone." True to Kilgallen's strength and integrity, she never disclosed the name of the source, even though the consequences could have been possible prosecution. One may only imagine the pressure she endured when at least one, and in all likelihood two, FBI agents descended on her home. Without legal counsel to ensure her rights, she faced down the agents, forcing them to return to Hoover with the proverbial tail between their legs. Just imagine the director's strong vocal response to their not having been able to break Kilgallen and discover her source. These were tough agents who had interrogated heavyweight criminals and brought them to their knees, and yet they had to tell Hoover that Kilgallen had won the interrogation battle. Kilgallen's acquisition and printing of the secret documents had begun with an apparent clandestine meeting with her friend at the commission. Based on her scathing Journal American columns and articles, her source must have been aware of the reporter's disdain for Hoover and questions she had about the commission's intention to pursue the truth about JFK's death. Kilgallen told no one of her secret source, but when she ran into Howard Rothberg, an interior designer and friend who was a founding member of her P.J. Clark's Science Club, she showed him a thick grouping of papers hidden inside the Life magazine cover depicting Lee Harvey Oswald holding the Mannlicher Carcano rifle the authorities swore he used to assassinate John F. Kennedy. When Rothberg asked, "What's this?" Kilgallen calmly replied, "It's just part of the Warren Commission report." Though Kilgallen showed calm on the outside, her heart was likely beating like that of a 100-yard dash Olympic sprinter. She knew she would have a chance to read Ruby's testimony before any other reporter did so. She could also publish it for the world to read while comparing his testimony at the Warren Commission with the Ruby trial testimony notes she had collected. Based on Kilgallen's reputation for truth-telling, Kingsbury Smith decided to rush the documents to print as soon as possible after consulting with his attorneys. The paper would have an exclusive, a scoop of unimaginable proportions since millions of people were awaiting the Warren Commission report with anticipation on a daily basis. In fact, one may only imagine what an incredible exclusive Kilgallen scored in light of the historical importance of Jack Ruby's Warren Commission testimony. Perhaps only the later disclosure of the Nixon White House tapes, exposure of the Pentagon Papers, and Edward Snowden's leak of classified information from the National Security Agency, NSA, in 2013 provide similar comparison. Bottom line? Kilgallen had embarrassed the director by exposing the Ruby testimony, and Hoover was not one to be embarrassed. She had made a fool of him, and in response, he intensified surveillance of her by FBI agents. When the story was published, Kilgallen added her own perspective based on, she said, reading the transcripts three times in one sitting. She wrote, "He was told to tell his story, and he did, in thousands of words and hundreds of sentences, some of which rambled on to the point of being without sense. But in the end, Ruby told much about himself." Kilgallen then added, "He opened the floodgates of his mind and unloosed a stream of consciousness that would have dazzled a James Joyce buff and enraptured a psychiatrist. Jack Ruby bared to the Chief Justice his emotions, his fears, his triumphs, and his ego, a large ego for such a small man." Kilgallen's hairdresser and confidant, Charles Simpson, had his own viewpoint of the danger Kilgallen faced by crossing swords with what he called the wrong people. He said during his taped interview, "She printed it on the front page of the Journal American before the president received it, and therein lies the tale. From then on, we were stalked. Mark Sinclair and me, our phones were tapped since they were trying to figure out where she got her information, that she could get this information before the president got it." Simpson added, "Actually, even though I didn't know anything about the assassination, these people, whoever they were, didn't know that. They didn't know what Dorothy may have told us. And yes, I kept it to myself and denied everything until recent years." Asked if it was safe to talk about it at the time of the interview, late 1990s, Simpson paused and then replied, No. Release of the Pentagon Papers, published by the Washington Post in 1971, offers context as to the risk Kilgallen endured by exposing what at the time amounted to government secrets, since Ruby's testimony before the Warren Commission was supposedly kept under lock and key. Like Catherine Graham, the Post's publisher, the first female publisher of a major newspaper in the U.S., Kilgallen had a choice to make when provided with Ruby's testimony: publish or not publish. This dilemma continued as her editors at the Journal American considered what possible repercussions the famed reporter and the newspaper might endure. Similarly, Graham was specifically told she and the newspaper could be held in contempt of court based on a previous court ruling if they printed the Pentagon Papers. The papers had been given to them by Daniel Ellsberg, an American activist and former U.S. military analyst who, while employed by the Rand Corporation, stole a top-secret Pentagon study of U.S. government decision-making in relation to the Vietnam War. While making her decisions, Graham, played by vaunted actress Meryl Streep in the 2017 Academy Award-nominated film The Post, was informed she actually could go to prison if convicted of contempt of court. Also, the Nixon administration threatened to destroy The Post if it did not bow down to White House demands. Kilgallen had her enemies, certainly J. Edgar Hoover for one. Graham had Nixon and his administration minions. Graham's advisors, with the exception of executive editor Ben Bradley, all scolded her in view of Nixon's threats to stop the presses and not publish the papers, but in the end she showed significant courage, stood firm despite the danger, and ordered the secret documents to be published. Nixon's lawyers took the case involving the Post and the New York Times, which had also published a portion of the papers, to the Supreme Court. But Graham's decision was vindicated, and the Pentagon Papers continued to be published.